This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm David Hatfield, and this is Classical Music Connection. Let's find out what's on today's program. In the BBC Music magazine for April of 2023, Charlotte Smith discovers Yehudi Menuhin's enduring festival in Gstaad, Switzerland. The Swiss Alps are home to some of the most dramatic scenery in the world. And taking the three-hour train journey from Geneva to Zonnenland does not disappoint. Lakes of the deepest blue, dense forests and lush green farmland. Waterfalls and majestic peaks make the journey a rare screen-free treat. Check your phone at your peril, for you may miss a natural marvel. It's little wonder, then, that Yehudi Menuhin was so enraptured with the region, making the town of Gstaad his family home in 1957. A summer season of concerts, suggested by the region's head of tourism, was all the incentive the violinist needed to set up a festival here. And what began with two modest performances featuring Benjamin Britten, Peter Pears, and French cellist Maurice Gendron gradually grew each year under Menuhin's stewardship to incorporate several months of chamber, symphonic, and operatic concerts. And in 1977, the introduction of the International Menuhin Music Academy for elite young performers. Today, the Gstaad Menuhin Festival and Academy is thriving under the direction of Christoph Müller, former manager of the Basel Chamber Orchestra, who assumed control of the event 20 years ago. Every summer, 2 months of top-class music-making does much to ensure the region is now known for more than its ski-friendly slopes. Luxury hotels, designer shops, and royal vacationers. It was Müller who steered the festival to calmer waters, following several years of turbulence under the more radical direction of violinist Gidon Kremer, whose artistic goals, the Gstaad website remarks tactfully, were not congruous with the previous four decades marked by Yehudi Menuhin. Among the many innovations of Müller's tenure have been the 2014 introduction of an annual 3-week Gstaad Conducting Academy for 10 selected participants from an average of 250 applicants, a week-long orchestral course for ambitious amateurs, and a comprehensive digital arm, which, since 2017, has made available online a great number of orchestral performances and masterclasses, and during 2 years of COVID disruption proved to be invaluable. True to the festival's origins, chamber music remains at its heart, but there are also choral and opera performances, concerts with an unconventional character, concerts in unusual places, discovery concerts for children, performances and open masterclasses featuring Gstaad Academy young musicians, all of whom receive free tuition following a rigorous audition process. Plus, concerts featuring the Gstaad Festival Orchestra since 2017 under the direction of Jaap van Zweden, and of which Müller is especially proud. The ensemble is comprised of leading orchestral musicians from around Switzerland, such as Bern, Basel or Zurich, Mueller explains, there is a core of around 15 players who have been coming back to play every season for years. They put together their own sections of players, and this is a great system, as they are responsible for the high quality of the orchestra. But the ensemble also has the character, energy, and excitement of a project orchestra, as the players come together just once a year. It feels special, as we don't know if that particular energy will ever be repeated. Vienna, Beethoven Delayed, was the theme of the 2022 season, which I attended for 3 days at the end of August, affording me the opportunity to take in a concert performance of Mozart's The Magic Flute in the impressively large and acoustically enhanced Gestalt Festival tent. A pure-voiced Sandrina Piau as Pamina, teamed with tenor Jeremy Ovenden in the role of Tamino, and a show-stealing Rocio Perez as a menacing Queen of the Night. Les Talents Lyriques under Christophe Rousset provided a crisp backdrop. The next day, I headed to a small Baroque church in the nearby town of Gesteig to hear Sibelius competition-winning violinist Christelle Lee, a 2022 Menuhin Heritage Artist, perform alongside cellist Jonathan Roosman and pianist Yek Wan Son Wu. The atmosphere in the intimate space contrasted perfectly with the grandeur of the previous evening, and the opportunity to hear Beethoven's Archduke up close and personal, alongside Haydn and a new commission by Martin Wettstein, demonstrated just how flexible the festival has become. The 2023 season, entitled Humility, offered an equally exciting range of over 60 concerts, with a timely emphasis on, quote, nature and other issues not entirely within our control, unquote. In the BBC Music Magazine for January of 2022, Daniel Jaffe enlightens us about composer Alexander Scriabin. Scriabin appears today a perfect example as to why listeners should not confuse a composer's work with his biography. Once revered, then subsequently reviled in both his own country and abroad, his late piano sonatas, concise, intense, and eerily atmospheric, are now recognized as extraordinary masterpieces ahead of their time. Yet, on the 150th anniversary of his birth, the man himself is regularly regarded today, even by several Scriabin aficionados, as an embarrassment. This is above all for his apparent delusion that he was the Messiah, a concept seemingly the more ludicrous given his effete bourgeois appearance and the fact that he stood little more than 5 foot tall. It does not help that by Russia's pre-revolutionary Julian calendar, which by the 20th century ran 13 days behind the Gregorian calendar used in the rest of Europe, Scriabin was born on Christmas Day. His one-time close friend and biographer Leonid Sabaniev added to the mythology by carelessly, or mischievously, claiming he died on Easter Day. Scriabin, in fact, died more than 3 weeks later. In 1904, while in Switzerland during his self-imposed exile from Russia, Scriabin admitted to preaching to Swiss peasants on the shore of Lake Geneva while he stood on a boat, having, some wags have added, failed to walk on water. In that same year, he confided to his friend Yuli Engel of his dream of creating an all-embracing mystery, quote, which could replace the old outdated gospel. Scriabin, recalled Engel, elaborated, a special temple has to be built for it, maybe here. And without looking, he took in the panorama of mountains with an undefined gesture. But maybe far from here, in India. This, it appears, was his first confession of his ambition to write his notorious and never fulfilled final magnum opus. Less than a year later, Scriabin was reading H.P. Blavatsky's The Key to Theosophy in French translation, a book which seemed to further fuel his ambition for his mystery project. Early in 1906, while in Bogliasco on the Italian coast, he met the Marxist philosopher Georgi Plekhanov, who had moved to Italy for the sake of his health. Plekhanov's wife, Rosalia, witnessed a lively conversation between her husband and Scriabin during one of their walks. As they approached a bridge, which spanned a river much reduced by the warm weather, the composer claimed that he could jump off the bridge and, through power of will, not be dashed on the rocks below, but would float unharmed in midair. To which Plekhanov dryly responded, "Try it." Scriabin did not oblige, although perhaps not simply due to pragmatism overruling a delusional idea. Scriabin and Plekhanov had, in the words of Rosalia, held their discussions in a teasing and jocular manner, and Scriabin's proposal on the bridge was a symbolist concept, an example of the artistic philosophical movement by which emotions are expressed by metaphorical images and language. Much later, Plekhanov confessed, "Our daily arguments at every meeting not only did not alienate us from each other, but even contributed a good deal to our mutual closeness." Clearly there was a strong mutual respect, though their respective philosophies were utterly different, albeit both in their different ways wished to find redemption for their fellow men. Plekhanov remembered, "It was very pleasant to dispute with Alexander Nikolaevich because he had the ability to assimilate his opponent's thought with surprising speed and fullness. When I met him in Bolyasko, he was completely unacquainted with the materialistic view of the history of Marx and Engels. I drew his attention to the important philosophical significance of this view. When I met with him in Switzerland a few months later, I saw that, while he had by no means turned into a supporter of historical materialism, he had managed to understand its essence so well that he could work with this doctrine considerably better than many hard-boiled Marxists, both in Russia and abroad." It is rather sad, if revealing, that such a testimony came from what might be thought a disinterested source, whereas the most damning portrayal originated from someone who had, for a long time, wholeheartedly shared Scriabin's dreams and outlook in life. Leonid Sabaneyev was a close friend and associate of Scriabin's in the final 5 years of the composer's life, visiting him almost every day. Indeed, the pianist Alexander Goldenweiser, another friend of Scriabin's, described Sabaneyev as not just a passionate disciple, but, so to speak, a Scriabinite prophet. A man of considerable intelligence who had some compositional training, Sabaneyev was in a better position than most to understand Scriabin both as a thinker and as a composer. His biography, Reminiscences of Scriabin, offers tantalizing glimpses of the final work Scriabin had in mind, but failed to commit to paper before his untimely death. This was not the long-planned mystery which had threatened to overwhelm Scriabin's creative and intellectual resources, but the preliminary action, an interim work, which his close friend, the symbolist poet Vyacheslav Ivanov, had suggested could be written as preparation for those who would participate in, not merely listen to, the mystery. Sabaniev wrote, Alexander Nikolaevich began to play something new, different, unfamiliar to me. It was, I recall, a fairly long episode of ineffable beauty, music of which I immediately caught something in common with that same famous prelude, Opus 74, number 2, which had left such a deep impression on me the previous season. There were mysterious, lingering harmonies, full of some otherworldly sweetness and sharpness, changing against the background of a static bass in fifths. The impression of this, perhaps the most powerful of all I had heard from Scriabin, was stronger even than the previous impressions of the Third Symphony, of the Sixth Sonata, of Prometheus. After Scriabin's death in 1915 from a blood poisoning due to a septic carbuncle that had formed on his upper lip, Sabaniev suddenly and viciously turned against his former idol, maybe out of chagrin for having fallen so fully under the composer's sway. In 1927, after emigrating from the Soviet Union, Sabaniev published a book, Modern Russian Composers. By then, he had immersed himself fully in the then highly fashionable theories of the Italian criminologist and phrenologist Cesare Lombroso, which, in Sabaniev's own words, had led to his studying in Lombroso's manner the mysterious relationship between genius and mental disease. Sabaniev admitted this not in his chapter on Scriabin, but in a chapter relating to another composer, Samuel Feinberg. Not surprisingly, this admission eluded Scriabin's scholars until researcher Simon Nichols, in his The Notebooks of Alexander Scriabin, highlighted Sabaniev's comment and its significance. As Nichols noted, Lombroso promoted a now discredited theory of genius as degeneration, claiming that signs of degeneration are found more frequently in men of genius than even in the insane. Such signs included smallness of the body, precocity, which Lombroso branded morbid and atavistic, and grandiose monomania. To Sabaniev, evidently, Lombroso's prognosis appeared a neat fit for Scriabin. As such, he described his former idol in Modern Russian Composers as the first consistent paranoiac to reduce musical insanity to a peculiar sort of scheme and even to a theory. In his final article about Scriabin, published in 1966, Sabaniev described the composer as a mad dreamer, a psychologically sick man even in his appearance. With even a once-devoted acolyte writing about Scriabin in those terms, it's no surprise that later scholars followed suit. But Sabaniev didn't stop at character assassination. In 1927, he wrote of Scriabin's work, "In his music we discern a dream of titanism, the dream of greatness and tragedy, but not greatness itself, not titanism itself, examples of which have been given us by geniuses like Beethoven or Wagner." That judgment was widely echoed, not least by Constant Lambert in his best-selling tome, Music Ho, published in 1934. The climaxes of Scriabin's Poème de l'Extase are angry waves beating vainly at the breakwater of our intelligence. The tide has since turned in Scriabin's favor, at least as a composer. Yet Sabaniev's poisonous invective against his character still has currency. Given Sabaniev's special relationship with the composer, coupled with the daunting task facing anyone contemplating getting to grips with Scriabin's actual worldview and the literature he read, this is hardly surprising. Only now, since Nichols' first publication of a reliable English translation of Scriabin's own writings, are we perhaps getting to grips with this extraordinary, eccentric, but certainly far from insane genius. In the BBC Music Magazine for September of 2023, we get to interview up-and-coming conductor Tim Anderson. Where were you born? London, UK. What would be your career highlights so far? Conducting a Charino world premiere in Klagenfurt during lockdown, the 30th anniversary production of Marc Anthony Tournage's Greek in London in 2018, and working with the phenomenal and fearless musicians of Klangforum Wien. Who are your musical heroes? Wagner, because there is no other composer in whose music I can so completely lose myself. And Ella Fitzgerald. What would be your dream concert? When I grow up, Tristan und Isolde. Meanwhile, I'm about to conduct two operas from my bucket list, Thomas Ade's Powder Her Face for Semperoper Dresden, and Brett Dean's Hamlet in one of the world's most iconic opera houses. The December 2023 issue of the BBC Music Magazine has an article by Ashutosh Khandelwal. He explains why Maria Callas has remained such a powerful influence on fans and singers. This woman is a miracle. Elizabeth Schwarzkopf's exclamation still resonates a century after Maria Callas's birth, celebrated this December. Recent years have seen the continuing apotheosis of the singer, dubbed La Divina, during her lifetime. The mounting tributes are testament to the enduring breadth and depth of the Callas legend. Hundreds of books in dozens of languages explore every detail of a complex, eventful life. Recordings, good and bad, continue to be rediscovered, remastered, repackaged, and re-released as every advance in technology attempts to capture the real, unvarnished voice of Callas. Exhibitions abound, devoted to the photographs, costumes, fashion, and jewelry that show Callas after her notoriously punishing regime of weight loss, in perfect tune with the style of the 1950s and 60s. Callas's life and art have been captured in plays, films, and documentaries, portrayed by performers as diverse as Meryl Streep, Fanny Ardant, and most recently Marina Abramovich, whose Seven Deaths of Maria Callas toured the world before arriving at English National Opera earlier this season. In this work, the celebrated performance artist portrays Callas on her deathbed in Paris, revisiting her life through the alter egos she inhabited on stage, exploring the notion of immortality through art. Today's great opera singers continue to pay homage to their inspirational idol. One memorable example is Angela Georgiou's 2019 solo album Homage to Maria Callas, the cover of which features the Romanian diva made up to look like La Divina. Perhaps, though, the most extreme example of Callas veneration to date was her reincarnation as a hologram. Indeed, a three-dimensional replica of the singer, computer-generated from film footage of her performances, was taken on a world tour in 2019. The ghoulish experiment served merely to demonstrate the limitations of virtual reality. The New York Times described the show as more like a séance than a concert. Meanwhile, the tributes keep coming. At the Cannes Music Festival this year, it was announced that the Chilean director Pablo Larraín would be filming a new biopic focusing on the singer's final lonely years in Paris before her death in 1977. Larraín already has experience in this genre. His biopics include Spencer, about Princess Diana, and Jackie, portrait of the woman who proved to be a nemesis of Callas in the doomed love triangle with the Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis. The new film, whose release date is yet to be announced, is entitled Maria and stars Angelina Jolie. A centenary is an occasion for celebration, but it's also an opportunity to grasp the roots of Callas's genius and what made her unique. In a 20-year career, Maria Callas changed the world of opera profoundly. Her approach to bel canto singing enabled audiences to rediscover the power of composers such as Rossini, Donizetti, and Bellini, whose operas were regarded in the early 19th century as lightweight baubles, devoid of the emotional depth of their romantic and verismo successors. Of course, there were great singers preceding Callas, who displayed many of the vocal pyrotechnics and luster of La Divina. In fact, Callas emerged from a long line of great singers who helped construct the image of the early 20th century operatic diva. The histrionic virtuosity of Luisa Tetrazzini, Amelie de Galicucci's prowess in the recording studio, and the heart-on-sleeve pathos of Claudia Muzio all provided essential ingredients in the alchemical mix that resulted in the phenomenon known as Callas. You've been listening to Classical Music Connection, brought to you each week by the Radio Reading Services of Greater Cincinnati, a service of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. I'm your host, David Hatfield, inviting you to join me again next week for Classical Music Connection.